True crime podcast listeners often have cool taste in, well, pretty much everything. If you're looking for a unique gift for a friend, loved one, or pick for yourself, Apparition Atelier is your go-to. Founded in 2018 and based in Cape Town, Apparition Atelier designs and creates handcrafted chainmail and scale mail jewelry, armor, accessories, and apparel. Every single one of their pieces is created uniquely by hand with attention to quality that will have you standing out from the crowd. Their full catalog is available online, and you can shop virtually there too. Head over to apparition.co.za to fall in love with your next most amazing accessory piece. He sets off on his mission as soon as the coast is clear. They've already started looking, and he needs to do it now, or it might be too late. The empty field is the best place, he's sure. Not many people go there, and he's certain it'll be quite some time until anyone finds her, if at all. He doesn't spot a single other person in the area, and he's satisfied he's made the right choice. But he has no idea that something else is watching. A flickering light on a camera, too far for him to see. But he is seen, and the image of his horrific mission is now on record. This is True Crime South Africa. I'm Nicole Engelbrecht, and you're listening to episode 176, The Murder of Courtney Peters. This episode is sponsored by Krypton Signs. You probably don't know this about me, but in my previous life, like pre-podcast, not pre-birth, I worked at a signage company for 12 years. Yeah, I'm one of those lifer employees. I still have a really soft spot for the signage industry, which I know sounds weird, but there's something about helping people to create one of the most important parts of branding for their business that feels like you're making a real difference. So when Krypton Signs wanted to come on board as a sponsor for the podcast, I thought that was a really cool full circle moment. If you're looking to make a bold statement with your business, Krypton Signs will bring your brand to life with custom signage that stands out. Whether you need eye-catching storefront signs, event banners, or vehicle wraps, they've got you covered. No job is too big or too small, and they deliver top quality results fast. Krypton Signs offers free consultations to help you design the perfect sign for your business. If you're ready to make your business impossible to ignore, visit the lovely folks over at Krypton Signs at www.kryptonsigns.co.za or call 069-409-7112 today for a free quote. That's Krypton Signs, your signage, your way. Call 069-409-7112 now and get started. Since 2019, True Crime South Africa has been telling the stories of the victims of violent crime in South Africa. The podcast is independent. That means no big or even little corporates fund it. And that's just the way I like it. And it's the only independent podcast in South Africa that consistently charts in the top 10. Keeping a podcast like this going is time-consuming, and for the most part, it remains a one-woman process. It's me. I'm the one woman. You? Yes, you. are the reason this podcast continues to flourish and help bring in tips on missing person and cold cases. If you'd like to help keep the show running, please consider supporting our sponsors, signing up to Patreon or PayPal, follow the show on the socials, as the kids say, and share it with your fellow partners in crime. You can find our social links and learn more about our sponsors at truecrimesouthafrica.com/donate. Shout out to this week's Patreon and PayPal superstars. A huge thank you goes out to Alicia Haramsa, Jermaine Lachmanen, Sarita Pick, Freddie Morgan, Jamie Yonka, and Melissa B for your support on Patreon, as well as Pietra Durich for your support on PayPal. Thank you so much, everyone. Your support really does make a huge difference. Patreon supporters get one additional exclusive episode a month, a shout out on the pod, and other exclusive contents, including Q&As with me as and when it's available. It's a minimum of $1 a month. I think you should do it. Please. And thank you. Kia ba. Up front, I must warn you that this episode contains discussion of child murder and rape. If you're familiar at all with the case of Courtney Peters, you will have an inkling of just how disturbing her murder was, and the details may be difficult to listen to. Equally, her story is just as important to tell. In 2017, when this case occurred, Courtney was one of 985 South African children murdered in the 2017-2018 reporting period. Since then, that number has only gone up, and only a small percentage of these children will ever receive any justice in a court of law. In researching this case, my resources included the judgment, documents from the NPA, an article from Zivamis, and several media articles. So let's get into episode 176, the murder of Courtney Peters.
The following episode may contain sensitive material, including descriptions of violence, sexual assault, or graphic descriptions of injuries to victims. If you feel you may be triggered by such material, please consider this before accessing our content. To access trauma counseling or services, please see the helpline information on our show notes.
Janita Peters and Aaron Faree started a relationship in the late 90s. The couple would never legally marry, but over the next two decades, they would have four children together and lived together as long-term partners. The family had lived in a few different locations over the years, but they would eventually move into a home in Elsie's River, which was owned by Aaron's sister. Janita and Aaron moved into the house with their two youngest children at the time. And while they were living there in 2014, Janita would give birth to a little girl they named Courtney. Also living on the property was Aaron's niece, Marsha, with her two children. Many of the families living in Elsie's River live very close to the poverty line, and although Janita and Aaron were able to clothe and feed their children every month, it was still a struggle. Aaron worked, and Janita did too, as often as she could get work. But with three mouths to feed and rent, transport and so many other costs, around the time that Courtney was born, they decided to rent out a room in the house to one of Aaron's friends. It seemed like the best choice. Rather than bring a complete stranger into their home, they would be bringing in someone Aaron had known since he was a child. And so it was that Mortimer Saunders began living with Janita, Aaron, and their children. Mortimer Saunders was the son of a pastor. He was in his late 30s when he moved into the house in Elsie's. He had two children of his own, but he was no longer in a relationship with the children's mother. After matric, Mortimer had studied toward and achieved a diploma in marketing, and since then he'd worked in call centres. His personal relationships were not in great shape, for two reasons. Throughout his life, Mortimer had found it difficult to trust anyone and regularly accused people close to him of trying to poison him. In addition, he had developed a serious drinking problem, although he would stop drinking shortly after he'd moved in with Janita and Aaron, and he managed to remain sober. Having been lifelong friends, Mortimer and Aaron got along really well. But things weren't always friendly between Mortimer and Janita. Janita would later say that the man liked to eavesdrop on conversations she had with her friends and relatives, and then he would carry that information back to Aaron and cause fights between the couple. Janita was annoyed by this trait of Mortimer's, but she usually kept her cool because the man had a regular income and his contribution to the household through rent and paying Janita to do chores like laundry helped the family a lot. She also said that despite his meddling ways, she did see him as a good man, and she'd never had any concerns about him being around her children. Mortimer watched Courtney grow up, and she would play with his daughter when she came to visit her father. He had a television and DSTV in his room, and he would often allow the children to sit on his bed and watch television with him. Janita would say that the children were always in his room as a group, though, and never alone. Although Janita didn't seem to have that big of an issue with Mortimer, it would soon become clear that his feelings of dislike toward her were far more intense. In 2017, Janita had been without work for quite some time. So when she was able to secure a full-time position as a cleaner at a restaurant in Paro, she and Aaron were elated. The additional income would be very welcome. With the employment opportunity, though, came the problem of childcare. Affordable childcare is an issue for most working parents, but those living in poverty, of course, experience this issue far more severely. As the cost of living has increased, it's become almost impossible for families to have one parent stay at home with the children. Two salaries are needed just to get by. But if there's no granny eager to watch her grandchildren during the day, parents can often find themselves spending a large chunk of their salaries on childcare alone. Add to that the expense of transport to and from work, and it can often mean that those earning minimum wage or just above are hardly coming out with any of their salary left over after just those two expenses. Janita Peters did have a group of people close to her that she was able to call on for assistance with childcare, but only if it was occasional. And once she was working every day, even family members were not willing to care for her two youngest children, who were just 6 and 3, and not yet attending school full-time, without some form of payment. On the 4th of May 2017, Janita Peters would say she found herself in a predicament. She needed to go to work, but she didn't have money to pay any of her usual babysitters. She would later say that it was a very rare occasion for her to leave her two youngest children without directly appointed care for a full workday. But on that day, she had done so. She said her youngest, Courtney, who was 3, and Courtney's older brother, who was 6, knew not to leave the house without an adult. And since there were two other adults on the premises, Mortimer, who was on leave from work, and Marcia, Janita said she'd convinced herself it would be okay. More will be said about this issue later on, and other members of the community the family lived in would accuse Janita of leaving her children home alone a lot more than she'd admitted to. On that morning, Janita got dressed for work. She fed Courtney porridge for breakfast and then checked in on her son, who was not feeling well and was still in bed. She then kissed Courtney and her son goodbye. As Janita walked out the door, Courtney called out her usual request for her mother to please bring her a party pack home. Janita smiled and promised she would, and then told the children to be good, and she'd see them later. and closed the door behind her. Around 7:30 a.m. that morning, Marsha, who lived in the granny flat at the back of the property, got up and took her older child to a family member down the road who cared for him during the day, as she was in charge of cleaning the house and doing laundry. She returned to her home and lay on the bed with her baby son for a little while. Around 8 a.m., she went into the main house to start cleaning and spotted Courtney's brother, but didn't see the little girl. She asked the boy where his sister was, and he said she'd gone to watch television in Uncle Morty's room. Marsha continued on with her chores, which took her back outside, and the next time she entered the house was about an hour later. She once again wondered about Courtney's whereabouts and walked to Mortimer's room. He was standing outside his bedroom door, and she asked if Courtney was still watching television. Mortimer said no, she'd left, but he didn't know where she'd gone. Marsha knew that Courtney would sometimes go a few houses up to play with another child of her age at a woman named Jolene's house, so she figured she must have gone there. She carried on with her cleaning, but was surprised when, a short while later, Jolene knocked at the door, asking if Courtney could come play with her daughter. Marsha told her that she thought the girl had already gone to her house, but Jolene said she hadn't seen her that day. Marsha asked Courtney's brother to go to several of the houses in the streets where Courtney would often play with friends and see if she was there. The boy returned soon after without any positive news. Around 10 a.m., Marsha and Jolene decided to walk to Marsha's sister's house to see if Courtney was there. It was pretty much the last possibility of houses where Courtney would feel comfortable enough to visit on her own. So when they arrived there and found the house locked up, the pair thought perhaps they'd somehow crossed paths with the woman and the child and Courtney had been taken back home. But she wasn't home when they got back either. Marsha and Jolene were unsure at this point what to do and still felt certain that Courtney had just gone to play with a friend and would return when she wanted lunch. Jolene went home, and Marsha carried on cleaning. At one point, Marsha's baby, who was sleeping on the couch nearby, started crying, and Mortimer walked into the room and picked the baby up, soothing him back to sleep. When she'd finished cleaning, Marsha took the baby back to the flatlet, and Mortimer returned to his room. Around 2 p.m. that afternoon, Marsha was going to head to the post office and went through the main house, and she noticed that Mortimer's room had been bolted from the outside, so she knew he'd gone out. Marsha's brother had arrived and was cleaning out the yard, and she told him that if Courtney came home while she was out, he should make sure she stays at the house. Marsha made her trip to the post office and returned to the house and found that Courtney was still not home. As she was wondering what her next step should be, Mortimer Saunders walked in the door and surprised her by giving her a CV she'd asked him to update for her. He'd promised to update it for her on his computer at work, but hadn't got around to it before he'd gone on leave, so he said he'd quickly gone to the library and sorted it out for her so she could start looking for work. Marsha was grateful and thanked Mortimer. He then mentioned that while he was out, he'd kept an eye out for Courtney, but he hadn't seen her. Marsha decided she would go back to her sister's house. When she got there, her sister was home, but she said she hadn't seen Courtney at all that day. Marsha said that it was at this point that she really started to panic. Around 4 p.m., Janita Peters was walking home from work when her son and a friend of his ran up to her and told her that Courtney was missing. At first, she told the children to stop talking nonsense, but she hastened her pace all the same, and upon arriving at home, the adults confirmed that Courtney had not been seen since that morning. Janita and the others spent a few hours rechecking the houses of Courtney's friends and relatives. They also went to the police station to ask whether anyone had brought the child there. But she wasn't there either. Around 7 p.m., Janita Peters made the excruciating decision to officially report her daughter missing. Captain Sean Taylor received a call regarding a missing child from Elsie's River that night. By the time the docket found its way to the investigating officer, the community had already mobilized and had been searching the neighborhood and surrounding areas for hours with no success. The following day, Captain Taylor began interviewing everyone who lived in the house with Courtney. For the next few days, the searches continued by community members and the police. Manholes and open areas were searched, and volunteers even requested to search the properties and dustbins of residents who would give permission. With Courtney's disappearance being so highly publicized and a massive talking point in the community, sightings flooded in to Captain Taylor. He and his team ran each one down without success. Additionally, scammers attempted to benefit from the situation through two ransom demands sent to Courtney's aunt. Of course, it made absolutely no sense that Courtney would have been the victim of a kidnapping for ransom, and this was quickly refuted. A few days into the search for the child, a resident of Elsie's River reported a strong foul smell coming from a large pile of rubble in an open field. Police attended the scene, and community members assisted in lifting large pieces of concrete, which had been dumped there. But the source of the smell was nothing more than rotting household rubbish. Although the initial community searches weren't particularly well organized and more an action of desperation, once the police began to harness the community interest and get the neighborhood watchers involved, the searches became more tactical. Each volunteer was given a pair of latex gloves and a whistle. They were instructed not to touch anything with their bare hands, and if they found something that could be of interest, they should blow their whistle and the police officer would come to them. For the first few days, police helicopters often circled Elsie's River, and there was a buzz of activity as everyone gave of their time to try and find the little girl. Municipal workers helped to search rubbish dumps and brought strong flashlights to shine down manholes. This level of energy could not be kept up, though. And after a few days, volunteer numbers began to dwindle, while authorities and missing person NGO members continued to widen their searches. Amid the searches for Courtney, police were given the name of a person who may be a suspect. Shortly after the initial interviews of the members of Courtney's household, Mortimer Saunders had suddenly remembered that he'd seen someone standing across the road from the house on the day Courtney had disappeared. The man he identified was a known criminal in the area and had been accused of sex offences in the past. Police interviewed the man, but he had a solid alibi for the day of Courtney's disappearance and allowed police to search his home with no evidence found that the child was ever there. 9 days after Courtney Peters disappeared, three community members who were also members of Neighbourhood Watch and missing persons organisations and Courtney's aunt were travelling with a police officer who'd been coordinating searches in the area. They were trying to identify areas that had not been searched as yet. Courtney's aunt suggested that they try an area in Epping near Beaufort Circle. It was essentially a large piece of open land that bordered several large factories in the industrial area. It was walled off and had one entrance from Elsie's River. The officer dropped the women off in the field and headed off to fill up with petrol, promising to return as soon as he was done. The women began walking through the field in a grid pattern to ensure they didn't miss anything. Around 1:30 p.m., one of the volunteers stumbled upon a pile of thorn bushes that didn't look quite natural. Then, peeking out from under the bushes, she saw a piece of denim fabric. As her eyes began to take in and process what she was seeing, she realized the denim was a pair of pants. The pants had an embroidered white flower on it, just like the pants Courtney had been wearing on the day she disappeared. The woman then saw a tiny pair of feet sticking out from the denim. She instantly knew that she had discovered the body of Courtney Peters. Over the hours that followed, the scene was cordoned off, and only the investigating officer, two pathologists, and the forensic team were allowed to enter. Everything happened very quickly after the discovery. Janita Peters and Aaron Faree were informed that a body had been discovered. They were collected from their home and taken to the mortuary, where the child's body had been prepared for viewing. The lingering hope that the parents had had for the last 9 days was dashed when they saw the body and quickly confirmed that it was indeed their daughter. 3-year-old Courtney Peters had been murdered. Police quickly contacted the factory owners in the area around the field and secured CCTV footage from their cameras. It was clear from the level of decomposition of Courtney's body that she had likely been killed on the day she disappeared, and her body did seem to have decomposed in that spot. So police started viewing the footage from the time on the 4th when she was last seen at her home. They didn't have to wait very long to spot something suspicious. Just after 2 p.m. that day, the cameras recorded a man wearing a red t-shirt walking slowly into the field from Elsie's River. Although the quality of the footage was not good enough to clearly identify the man's face, it was clear that he had something slung over his shoulder. In the footage, he walked to the area where Courtney's body had been discovered, and although the exact location was in a blind spot for the cameras, the man was seen walking away from that same area just minutes later without the item he'd had slung over his shoulder. The day after Courtney was found, Janita Peters was asked to come into the police station to view the footage. She watched the clip several times, and when asked whether she recognized the man, Janita said no. She had no idea who he was. Later that same day, the canine units arrived at the Peters home, and dogs trained in the detection of human bodily fluids searched the house. The first dog that entered the house led its handler straight to Mortimer Saunders' room. The man was not home, so police made entry into the room and the dog positively indicated at several locations. The handler attempted to reset the dog by taking him out of the house and re-entering, but each time he did, the dog alerted at the exact same spot. Another canine officer gave exactly the same indication, and neither dog indicated anywhere else on the property. Janita Peters watched on in horror, and then she asked Captain Taylor if she could speak with him. With an ashen face, Janita admitted to Captain Taylor that she'd not told him the truth when he'd shown her the footage of the scene where her daughter's body had been found. She had actually recognized the man. She knew exactly who it was, and now the dogs had just confirmed it. The man in the footage, she said, was Mortimer Saunders. She told Captain Taylor that she hadn't wanted to believe what she was seeing, and she tried to convince herself that it couldn't be true. Mortimer Saunders was now suspect number one, and he was nowhere to be found. Taylor had Janita phone Saunders and tell him that the police wanted to speak with him at the police station. Taylor didn't want Saunders to know that the dogs had indicated in his room or that he'd been identified in footage, so he asked Janita to say nothing more than that. Saunders answered his phone and expressed his condolences to Janita on the news that Courtney had been found dead. She told him that the police wanted to speak with him, and Saunders wanted to know what they were saying and why they wanted to speak with him specifically. Janita ignored his questions and simply said that this was all she knew and he must come in right away. Saunders agreed, saying he'd just gotten out of a taxi and he would take another shortly to the police station. Mortimer Saunders never arrived and was uncontactable after that point. An alert was sent out to all police officers in the area to keep an eye out for Mortimer Saunders. With the community buy-in to the search for Courtney, the news that the police had been at the house with dogs, and now that they were wanting to speak with Saunders, also spread. Around 11 p.m. that night, an officer on patrol duties received an anonymous telephone call from a resident of Elsie's River. The woman told the officer that she knew the whereabouts of the man they were searching for in connection with Courtney's murder. She gave him directions and said she'd seen the man enter the house less than 10 minutes before, and she was familiar with him and certain it was Mortimer Saunders. The officer called for backup and approached the house. He saw a light and a television on in a back room of the house, and the door was standing open, so he approached there first. There on the couch was Mortimer Saunders. The officer introduced himself and asked Saunders to confirm who he was. Saunders stood up and started to back away from the officer, his eyes flicking to the doorway. Concerned that the man was about to flee, the officer reached out and grabbed him by his pants pocket, swiveling him around and cuffing him in one swift motion. He read the man his rights and then took him back to Elsie's River police station. As soon as the investigating officer was advised that Saunders was under arrest, he went through to the station and began to interview him. Saunders declined to have legal representation with him during the interview and instead agreed to tell Taylor what had happened. From the moments of his arrest, Saunders did not deny causing the death of Courtney Peters. His claimed intent would be called into question, though, and he would change up his version around a matter that had come to light after Courtney's autopsy. The 3-year-old had been sexually assaulted. Mortimer Saunders' version was as follows, and please note that the following details are very difficult to listen to. He claimed that on the morning of the 4th of May he'd been asleep when Courtney had wandered into his room and asked to watch television. He was irritated at being woken up, but agreed and let her sit there for a while. He then told the girl that she must leave, as he wanted to carry on sleeping. Courtney had done so, he claimed, but she'd come back less than half an hour later and woken him up again. Saunders said that he'd been enraged at the child waking him up again, and this was compounded by his intense dislike for Janita Peters. In that moment, he claimed he decided he was going to poison Courtney and make her sick, just to get back at her mother. Saunders claimed he'd purchased ant poison 8 months before to treat an ant issue in his room, and he'd gone to the kitchen and mixed an amount of the poison into a glass of cool drink. He then returned to his room where Courtney was watching television and told her to drink the cool drink. She initially refused, but he threatened her. The child began to cough, and some of the liquid splattered across her chest and face. At that moment, he claimed, he heard Marcia calling for Courtney. The child tried to respond and call out to Marcia for help. Saunders said he became afraid and punched Courtney in the head. He then slapped his hand over her mouth so she couldn't scream and grabbed a towel, which he placed in and over her mouth and nose. He simultaneously held his other hand around her neck to close her windpipe. After a while, Courtney's body became limp, and he realized that she was dead. He wrapped her in a blanket and placed her in the corner of his room. He then stepped outside his room just as Marcia was about to knock to ask if Courtney was there. Upon seeing her, He told her that Courtney had left and he didn't know where she'd gone. While Saunders wasn't really hesitant to explain how he had killed Courtney, it took some more convincing to get him to admit to the sexual assault. And even then, he framed it very specifically. At first, he said the location at where he'd sexually assaulted Courtney was in the field where her body was found. Later, though, he admitted that it had actually occurred in his bedroom. Throughout, Saunders claimed that the only reason he had removed Courtney's underwear was because he wanted to try and throw police off his trail and have them looking for a known child sex offender. So he had digitally raped the child. He claimed that when he'd done this, he had found himself becoming aroused and had then masturbated over the child's body. He denied ever raping the child with his penis. He was also adamant that all of this had happened after Courtney was dead. He would later point out the exact spot where he'd left her body and confirmed that he'd waited until Marcia had left the house that afternoon to bundle Courtney's body into a plastic bag and walk through to the field in Epping. He'd not been aware that there were cameras in the area. Mortimer Saunders was formally placed under arrest for the rape and murder of 3-year-old Courtney Peters. Upon being informed of Saunders' arrest and confession, Courtney's parents were horrified that the man that they'd trusted, who had been Aaron's friend for almost his entire life and watched Courtney grow from birth, could have done this horrendous thing right under their noses. Perhaps even more disturbing was how he'd seemed completely fine afterwards. Even though Saunders claimed he hadn't intended to kill Courtney, he was incredibly calm after doing so. Marcia recalled the moment she had met Saunders at his bedroom door, now understanding that he had killed Courtney just moments before that. And she said that there was absolutely no sign that there was anything wrong. He had seemed completely normal. Saunders had even helped to contribute to several of the searches, and of course provided that tip-off that seemed to implicate a suspected sex offender in the area. Janita said Saunders had comforted her as she cried while Courtney was missing, telling her not to be afraid because he was sure the child would be found safe and sound. All the while, he knew very well that this was not true at all. In the days after Courtney's body was found and Saunders was arrested and charged, the energy that had swept through the community, galvanizing everyone to search for her with hope, shifted into anger. And it wasn't just Saunders they were angry at. Very often, police had to be called to the Peters home because crowds of people had formed outside the house demanding that Janita come outside. Somehow the information that Janita had initially lied to Captain Taylor about the identity of the man in the footage had gotten out, and this had morphed into claims that the woman had been having an affair with Saunders and had tried to protect him. Some even suggested that she'd known he'd killed Courtney from day one. None of this was true, of course. Quite the opposite, in fact. Saunders seemed to deeply despise Janita, even more than she'd ever understood. But the community did not want to hear that. In many minds, she had purposefully left her child alone in the clutches of a pedophilic murderer. And now she should face the same consequences as him. For a while, Janita was at risk of being charged with negligence for having left her 2 youngest children without a direct caregiver that day. This possibility hung over her head right up until the end of Saunders' trial. She would later say that if that happened, she would accept her punishment. She did understand and accept that she'd left her child at risk that day. And now she, her daughter, and the rest of her family had paid the ultimate price for her poor choice. Interestingly, although it was clear that in their family, Janita was the main caregiver for the children, not once was Aaron's level of culpability questioned. He was the children's father. He lived with them every single day, too. Yet somehow, in the court of public opinion, the responsibility of organizing care for the children while simultaneously working a full-time job lay solely on their mother. Ultimately, though, possible negligence and sharing of blame aside, it was Mortimer Saunders who had done the unthinkable. And considering the timing of the child's murder on the very day that she had no direct adult supervision, the police and eventually the prosecution didn't believe the events of that day had been at all coincidental. On the 17th of May, Saunders appeared in court for the first time. The courtroom was packed to the brim and the public's anger was so clear that a line of police officers in bulletproof vests stood in formation around the accused. Saunders' representative told the judge that he did not wish to apply for bail, but did ask that he be moved from the general correctional facility to the hospital section, as he'd been threatened on several occasions and was in fear of his life. The request was granted. As Saunders awaited his next court date, memorials were held for Courtney across Elsie's River and the surrounding areas, including at the spot where her body had been found. At Saunders' next court appearance on the 24th of May, Janita Peters attended, but she soon discovered that this would not be an easy thing for her to do in the future. The community's anger toward her had not abated, and it seemed unlikely to do so in the near future. It would take a full year for Mortimer Saunders' trial to begin in the High Court. During that period, Janita Peters had been in and out of hospital with serious health issues. But in May 2018, when the trial started, she was due to be the prosecution's first witness. Before she could take the stand, though, Saunders had to officially enter a plea to each charge, and his plea statement had to be read into record. Saunders pleaded not guilty on the main count of rape, but guilty on an alternative count of committing a sexual act with a corpse. And he pled not guilty on the main count of murder, but guilty on murder without premeditation and or planning. His version in his plea statement was as I explained earlier. The prosecution rejected his pleas. They told the judge that in their view, the evidence showed that Saunders had raped Courtney and there was enough evidence to show he'd likely done so before he had killed her, and not after. In addition, they did not accept that Saunders hadn't planned Courtney's murder and they felt sure that they could prove premeditation. As a result, the judge entered pleas of not guilty on Saunders' behalf to both charges. When Janita Peters took the stand, she was warned by the prosecution in terms of Section 204 of the CPA, specifically in respect of Sections 305(3)(a) and B of the Children's Act, 38 of 2005, relating to abuse or deliberate neglect of a child, as some of the questions that may be put to her by the state may incriminate her. Janita accepted the warning and proceeded to testify. She gave evidence about the situation between her and Saunders, saying that although they were not exactly friendly, she'd had no idea that he'd hated her as much as he now claimed. She said that she still couldn't quite believe that the man who'd been so good with her children, as well as his own, could possibly have killed her daughter. But the evidence and Saunders' own admission gave her no choice but to accept that she'd allowed a monster into her home. She also accepted that she held some responsibility for Courtney's death because she had left her without direct supervision that day. During her testimony, Janita would be asked the same question every other person who lived in or had spent time in the house would be asked. Was there an ant problem in the house? No, Janita said. They'd never had an ant problem. Thereafter, Marcia testified, followed by Yvonne Schultz from the Neighbourhood Watch, who'd found Courtney's body, and had also conducted a search of the house before that, and had been in Saunders' room. Both confirmed that there had not been an ant problem in that room or anywhere else in the house at any time. The pathologist's testimony would, of course, be some of the most harrowing evidence given in the case, and many members of the public and Courtney's family were unable to sit through it and had to leave. Dr. Dempers testified that during the initial autopsy, external blunt force injuries were present on Courtney's face, torso, and limbs. A deep scalp hemorrhage was noted without skull fractural brain injury, which could clearly be identified. There were also features of pressure to the neck noted, and genital injury was also noted. Courtney's autopsy was conducted on the same day that Saunders confessed and told police that he'd administered poison to the child. When Dempers received this information, he restarted the autopsy process and took samples of tissue from various areas of Courtney's body to send for toxicology tests. Originally, Dr. Dempers had been of the opinion that asphyxia by smothering or strangulation had been the primary cause of death. After the toxicology results came back, he amended this to include the possibility that poisoning may have contributed to the child's death as well. Initially, Dr. Dempers had been unable to determine for sure whether the sexual assault had taken place pre- or post-mortem. He had felt that this was such an important element to clarify, though, that he'd applied for permission to use specialized testing, which would determine whether the damage to the vaginal canal had been caused while blood was still flowing to the tissue or after blood flow had already stopped. This specialized test confirmed that there was still blood flow to the cells of that tissue when the damage occurred. This means that although Courtney may have been unconscious and near death, she was not dead when she was raped. Another aspect of Dr. Demper's testimony that cast serious doubt on Saunders' version was that the doctor had found seminal fluid in the area of the sexual organ called the vaginal vault. This is the expanded end of the vaginal canal at the internal end of the vagina. When asked how he would expect seminal fluid to be deposited there, he said that there was a small chance it had been transferred into the vagina when the body was being moved, and also that if one had seminal fluid on their hands, it could be transferred that way by digital penetration. But the prosecution would point out that Mortimer Saunders had claimed he'd only become aroused and removed his penis from his pants after digitally raping Courtney, so he would not have had seminal fluid on his hands at the time, by his own version. It was also unlikely, Dr. Dempers said, that the seminal fluid would remain on the fingertips all the way through the vaginal canal and not get rubbed off before being deposited into the vaginal vault. Dr. Dempers testified that in about 85% of the cases he had seen, seminal fluid had found its way into the vaginal vault through a penis ejaculating there. Another two witnesses for the prosecution would take Dr. Demper's evidence further. The first was Chief Forensic Analyst Jacobus van Sail from the National Department of Health's Forensic Chemistry Laboratory in Woodstock. He tested the toxicology samples taken in Courtney's autopsy. He testified that he had identified the presence of a pesticide in the samples. The dosage contained in the samples at the time of testing was 0.8 milligrams per liter. He noted that this far exceeded the known lethal dose to adults, which is 0.6 milligrams per liter. And it was important to note that he was measuring the levels more than 9 days after Courtney's death, and therefore accounting for degradation of tissue, it was entirely possible that the actual dose administered to her was even higher than that. He explained that even with a high dose, the type of poison used is relatively slow acting, and so there would have been an opportunity to intervene and save Courtney's life for quite some time after the poison had been administered. The fact that such a high dose was still present in the tissue also meant that Courtney had died shortly after ingesting the poison, because metabolism stops at death. The poison itself could not have killed her that quickly, so some other mechanism had to have caused her death. Next, the DNA analyst testified that bodily fluids, which was possibly semen, found on a t-shirt Courtney had been wearing, had been positively matched back to Mortimer Saunders. Unfortunately, due to the degradation of the DNA in the vaginal vault, no positive match could be attained there. In addition to these witnesses, all of the police officers involved in the pertinent elements of the investigation and arrest also testified, and then the state rested its case. Quite early on, Mortimer Saunders had insisted that he wanted his own pathologist to look at the autopsy evidence and provide their opinion, especially around the injuries related to the sexual assault. Again, he seemed very keen on avoiding a rape charge and being associated with the rape of a live 3-year-old, but seemed less concerned with being found guilty of a necrophilic act. Although it was a process to get this cost approved because Saunders was using a legal aid attorney, it did eventually happen, and his defence opened with, firstly, an acknowledgement that he would not be testifying in his own defence, and then his own pathologist witness took the stand. Dr. Naidu testified mostly around the sexual abuse injuries and proposed an opinion different to Dr. Demper's, as related to whether the injuries to Courtney's genitals had occurred pre- or post-mortem. In fact, Dr. Naidu went as far as to say that all of the discolorations he'd seen on Courtney's face, torso and neck appeared to him to be as a result of decomposition changes. Despite being reminded that Saunders had actually admitted to hitting and smothering and strangling Courtney, and this would in fact line up with that version, Dr. Naidu stuck with his conclusions he'd reached. After Dr. Naidu stepped down, the defence closed their case. In closing arguments, the state said that they felt it was clear from the evidence that Mortimer Saunders had intended to kill Courtney Peters. Many witnesses had testified that there was no ant problem in the home, and it would be strange for someone to immediately think of poisoning a 3-year-old on the spur of the moment. So the only inference that could be drawn was that Saunders had purchased that poison with the intention of using it on a human being. In addition, the state said that the premeditation was clear in that Saunders had left his room, gone down to the kitchen, and prepared the deadly drink for the child, putting a huge dose of poison into the cool drink. There were many opportunities during this time for him to change his mind, but he stuck to his plan, because it was a plan, a premeditated one. In addition, his claim that he'd only wanted Courtney to get sick was equally unfounded, because of the size of the dose he'd given her, and also the fact that after she drank the liquid, he'd almost immediately strangled her. If he'd only wanted her to get sick, he could have just let her go and let the poison do its work. With regard to the rape charge, the state said that Dr. Demper's evidence proved that Courtney had been alive when she'd been raped. Although she may have been unconscious, and the manner of injuries to her genitals, as well as the semen deposited in the vaginal vault, proved that Saunders had indeed raped the child with his penis. The state asked Judge Pearl Mantame to find Saunders guilty of both rape and murder. In the defence's closing arguments, they argued that nothing about what Saunders had done that day was thought out, and it all smacked of spur-of-the-moment decision-making. In addition, he said that the testing conducted to prove pre- or post-mortem rape still held an element of doubt, and that should be sufficient to believe Saunders when he said Courtney was deceased and he had digitally raped her. The judge asked the defense lawyer if he could explain why his client would become aroused by the body of a deceased three-year-old if all he was trying to do was fake evidence of a sexual assault. That was a question that set a heavy silence over the courtroom, and one for which the lawyer didn't really have a good answer. On the 7th of November 2018, Judge Mantame handed down her verdict. She found Mortimer Saunders guilty of both the rape and premeditated murder of Courtney Peters. She called his actions vicious, brutal, inhumane, and ruthless, and rejected his version that he'd only meant to make Courtney sick, and even seriously doubted that his motive had anything to do with the child's mother. Courtney was not just Janita's child. She was also Aaron's daughter. Aaron and Mortimer had been friends since they themselves were not much older than Courtney. The judge could not see how it was possible that Mortimer could hate Janita so much that he would kill Aaron's daughter. It simply made no sense to her. The judge was also of the opinion that Saunders had specifically waited for a day when there would be fewer adults in the home to carry out his plan. With regard to the rape charge, the judge rejected Saunders' version and found that the evidence pointed to a rape with his penis before Courtney had died. She called what the child had to endure before her death torture. Also, in her judgments, Judge Mantame relieved Janita of any charges related to negligence. She expressed that while it was not the ideal situation, and certainly no child should have to go without direct adult supervision, she also had to take into account that childcare is particularly difficult for those living in poverty. Also, the judge mentioned that Janita did not technically leave the two young children completely alone in an empty house. The perpetrator of this crime did not break in or snatch Courtney off the streets. The murderer and rapist was, after 3 years of living in the house and a decades-long relationship with the child's father, essentially part of the family unit. A month later, in December 2018, Judge Mantame handed down her sentence. She gave Mortimer Saunders two life sentences. In a very rare method of sentencing, Judge Mantame said that the life sentences should be served consecutively rather than concurrently. Now, this almost never happens because in most cases on appeal, this will be overturned. The thinking behind this is that we all only have one natural life, and therefore when the first life sentence ends by death, the second sentence will never be served. So, really, it's a moot point. He will still become eligible for parole at 25 years into his sentence, but the judge's method of sentencing may influence the parole board at that time, but that remains to be seen. What is far more effective in consecutive sentencing is handing down long determinate sentences, like two 25-year determinate sentences to be served consecutively. But that also runs a risk, and premeditated murder should receive a life sentence, as should the rape of a three-year-old. It's a tricky one, but I do understand that the judge wanted to send a message. Saunders immediately asked to appeal his sentence, but his request was turned down. Although the community and Courtney's family were satisfied with the sentence, it became very clear that the child's death was a significant before and after event for many people, particularly her family. Community members expressed that they still held a lot of disdain toward Courtney's parents, her mother in particular, and it's unlikely that the Peters family would ever quite feel the same about their neighbours again, nor perhaps vice versa. It's also clear and completely understandable that the family itself continued to deal with feelings of deep grief, and for some, survivor's guilt. In several pieces of reporting around the trial, it was mentioned that Courtney's second oldest sibling, who would have been around 15 years old at the time, had felt a deep sense of guilt around her sister's murder. The young girl was at school when her sister was killed, and it's unknown how and why these feelings of responsibility for what happened to her developed. But I'm sure that the girl had often been a caregiver for her little sister. And when children are given such a role, when they're so young themselves, it can be quite difficult to separate their role as children and their implied role as caregivers. And so it happened that on the 2nd of September 2019, another person went missing from the Peters house. Courtney Peters' now 17-year-old sister vanished after leaving on a taxi to visit friends. The girl's name is in the media, but I'm not going to use it here. Reports at the time say that her mom had seen her off and she was meant to return the same day, but never did, and no one could find her. It would later emerge that the girl had intended to go home that day, but had gotten into the wrong taxi. And when the driver realized she wanted to go to Elsie's River, which was not where he was going, he tried to help her make her way home, even offering her money to take another taxi. The man had come forward when he'd seen the girl reported as missing on social media. While he was trying to help her get home, the driver said that she'd changed her mind and told him to drop her off somewhere else. Thankfully, this time the case had a very different ending, and Courtney's sister was located the next day by police. She, however, told them and a social worker that she did not want to go home. The girl expressed that she, quote, did not want to go back to that house, end quote, or to live with her family. Eventually, she was settled with her older sister, who hadn't lived at home since before Courtney was murdered, and missing persons NPO members were helping to get her care from social workers and counsellors, as it was clear to them, they said, that the young girl was in crisis. Now, I have absolutely no idea what was behind the young girl's feelings toward her family, but I also can't imagine having to still live in the house where your little sister was murdered, especially if you have feelings of guilt around that. But this, again, is the difference between a person with access to resources who experiences this type of grief and having the option to just pick up and move, and a person without access to much resources, who really has no choice but to stay where they are, in the house where the horrors occurred, and where every single minute of every day you're reminded of what happened to your 3-year-old sister or daughter, in the room where the cleverly masked monster lived. Courtney Peters lived just 3 short years. It's quite difficult to fathom being murdered at that age. And I don't know that I even really want to think about what must have gone through her mind. I can only hope that she was unconscious for most of it. Courtney was not born to be a hashtag or a symbol of activism. And the fact that her name has become synonymous with the fight against child rape and murder is actually incredibly sad. But I guess if we don't have that, then all we have is a gaping hole. And a man who, for reasons only he will ever truly know, committed a truly horrendous act. Courtney's short life did have a tremendous impact on many, many people, especially those who lived in her community. At one of the many memorial services held to commemorate her, a community spokesperson said something with which I'd like to end out this episode. I think it perfectly captures the huge impact that such a short life had, but one that she should never have had to make. Courtney's death brought us together. Courtney was not a child that came out of a mansion. She did not travel in luxurious cars. She came out of an ordinary family. Courtney's death brought unity to Elsie's River. I want to tell you, for an ordinary child that was not well known in this community, this world, not this country, but this world was brought to a halt by her. Courtney Peters, rest gently. If you'd like to hear more victim-focused true crime content, please subscribe to True Crime South Africa on Spotify or the platform you're using to listen right now. If you're looking for something still related to real-life stories, but often with a more positive slant, you can check out my new podcast series, I Lived Through This. You can follow both podcasts on social media. We're on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. I'll be back next week with another episode. Until then, thank you for your support, and I'll chat to you soon.